gobernador que no se vaya con una fortuna a su casa. Por supuesto, a ellos no les interesa la seguridad de los periodistas. Están muy ocupados enriqueciéndose. Esa es una de las razones de que tantos y tantos compañeros caigan un día así y otro también. Ya estuvo bien. Hay que ponerle un remedio al asunto. No es casual que tanto las autoridades como las bandas criminales estén inmiscuidas en los asesinatos de periodistas. Ni a esas autoridades corruptas ni a esos delincuentes les interesa que haya un verdadero ejercicio periodístico. No quieren que nosotros hagamos nuestro trabajo, hagamos la denuncia pertinente, el análisis que espera la sociedad y el trabajo que esperan nuestros lectores, la gente que ve noticieros en televisión o los escucha en radio, en internet. Están estas autoridades radicalmente en contra del periodismo libre por la misma razón que lo están en contra los delincuentes. Los delincuentes sin cargo oficial, quiero aclarar. El problema, pues, es que tenemos que exigir un día sí y otro también y machacar sobre el asunto que se aclaren los asesinatos de nuestros compañeros. Esa es la única manera de evitar que continúe esta matanza infame, esta orfandad en la que se deja a tantos hijos de colegas nuestros. La única exigencia que podemos levantar hoy, y es así indeclinable, es justicia. Justicia para todos, justicia para los mexicanos, porque insisto, no somos el único gremio agredido. Los mexicanos en su conjunto han sido objeto de una matanza. 100,000 asesinados en el sexenio de Felipe Calderón, y andamos en los 80,000 en el presente. Decenas de miles de desaparecidos, cientos de miles de desplazados. Efectivamente, los periodistas no somos los únicos que sufrimos este estado de indefensión.
Durante el evento en honor a Manuel Buendía, los comunicadores mexicanos hablaron de formas de fortalecer el gremio y establecer mecanismos de protección en caso de amenazas o persecución. El presidente de Estados Unidos, Donald Trump, reacciona en un tuiteo a las declaraciones de Angela Merkel de Alemania sobre el cuestionable apoyo de Washington a Europa. Bricio Segovia viene con los detalles.
El presidente estadounidense Donald Trump ha reaccionado a las declaraciones de Angela Merkel en las que cuestionaba el apoyo de Estados Unidos a Europa y ha aludido a dos cuestiones. Primero, a un déficit masivo, dice el presidente, que tienen en el ámbito comercial con Alemania, y segundo, ha criticado el aporte económico que hace Alemania a la OTAN, que se encuentra por debajo del 2% del Producto Interior Bruto recomendado para los países miembros. Estas eran las palabras que dedicaba a Donald Trump Angela Merkel justo después de participar en esta cumbre del G7.
En cierto modo, los tiempos en los que podíamos contar plenamente con otros países se acabaron. Así lo he sentido en los últimos días. Y por lo tanto, solo puedo decir, nosotros, los europeos, debemos tomar nuestro destino con nuestras propias manos. Por supuesto, seguiremos siendo amigos de Estados Unidos y Reino Unido. También debemos tener buenas relaciones con nuestros vecinos, con Rusia y otros países. Pero debemos saber que tenemos que luchar por nuestro futuro como europeos. Y me gustaría hacerlo con ustedes.
Las tensiones entre Estados Unidos y Alemania se hacían más pronunciadas justo después de esta cumbre en Europa, una cumbre en la que también pues varios de estos mandatarios participaron en otra, en la de la OTAN. En ambas, el presidente estadounidense dejó muy claro sus pocas intenciones de continuar en el Acuerdo de París, un acuerdo para limitar los gases contaminantes y así controlar los efectos del cambio climático, una posición que la mayoría de líderes europeos pues apuestan por que vaya adelante este Acuerdo de París. Y Angela Merkel fue muy clara en su mensaje cuando dijo que no estaba satisfecha con los resultados que había tenido después de encontrarse, reunirse con el presidente estadounidense y discutir sobre esta temática.
Por otro lado, los preparativos para la constituyente pasan a la fase de registro de candidatos que harán el país sudamericano de Venezuela uno de los más democráticos del mundo. Beatriz Yáñez amplía la información.
De elegir al mejor o la mejor que vaya a la constituyente.
Quedan apenas unas horas para que comience la inscripción de los candidatos para la Asamblea Nacional Constituyente a través de la página web del Consejo Nacional Electoral. Las horas previas están siendo intensas. Preparativos, debate y más debate para elegir a los mejores candidatos en cada uno de los sectores populares. 127 comunas del estado Miranda están reunidas hoy aquí, están debatiendo en estos momentos cuál va a ser la metodología para seleccionar a sus postulantes, que durante la jornada de mañana y el jueves tendrán que inscribirse en el Consejo Nacional Electoral con aspiraciones a ser elegidos como constituyentistas.
Ahorita vamos a crear la metodología de cómo lo vamos a hacer, cómo, de qué manera lo vamos a elegir, si lo vamos a elegir por comuna, si lo vamos a elegir por currículo, si lo vamos a elegir según su trabajo social, y estamos ahorita en base de la metodología.
Los postulantes deben ser venezolanos por nacimiento, mayores de edad, estar inscritos en el registro electoral, haber residido 5 años en la entidad territorial correspondiente o, en caso de presentarse en el nivel sectorial, llevar en él también 5 años y presentar constancia del mismo. En esta asamblea comienzan a salir postulantes de cara a la inscripción de la jornada del miércoles. Les preguntamos cuál debe ser el perfil del candidato perfecto.
Primero, el perfil de la conciencia, conciencia revolucionaria, socialista ante todo, como lo dicen nuestras leyes del poder popular, sobre todo del trabajo en colectivo, del trabajo en común, del trabajo de los que nosotros padecemos en las bases.
¿Por qué me postulo? Me postula las bases, me postula el pueblo. Es un proceso que está llamando nuestra dirigencia político-militar a participar el pueblo. Es el momento en que el pueblo participa para refundar la patria.
En otro punto de la ciudad de Caracas, el movimiento de pobladores, que trabaja con insumos de la Gran Misión Vivienda para construir edificios como este para la comunidad, también debate sobre la constituyente.
Primero, el objetivo es la paz. Y el objetivo es que la mayoría de la gente entienda que se tiene, bueno, los opositores que vengan y debatan con nosotros, que abiertamente, que debatan, que se postulen también. ¿Sabe? Nosotros decimos que es ser valiente y a postularse en una constituyente para ponernos de acuerdo.
Idaira será candidata en el nivel territorial por el estado Miranda. Nos enseña los logros conseguidos por la revolución. Un ejemplo es este edificio del centro de Caracas, donde viven 36 familias. Es un edificio hecho, dicen, en comunidad y para la comunidad. Asegura que mantener logros como este dependen del éxito de estas elecciones, que prevén constitucionalizar, por ejemplo, las misiones del gobierno. Los candidatos que se presenten durante las jornadas del miércoles y el jueves deberán recaudar el 3% de los apoyos de su municipio o sector.
En donde se van a encontrar una señal donde pueden ustedes apretar allí y van a encontrar listados las juntas municipales donde deben llevar los recaudos con todos los requisitos para que puedan la Junta Nacional Electoral evaluar esas postulaciones.
Los candidatos deberán presentar el recaudo de sus apoyos entre el 6 y el 10 de junio. Esther Yáñez, Caracas, Venezuela, Telesur.
En Venezuela, el contrabando en la frontera con Colombia sigue siendo fuente de desestabilización. Mónica Vistali anduvo por la región y preparó el siguiente reporte.
Cerca de la frontera, el problema es la gasolina. Se la llevan a Colombia, hasta con mangueras, y a pueblitos como este no queda casi nada. Y ahora que la oposición volvió a trancar vías como forma de protesta, la situación empeoró. La gasolina, cuando llega, se revende 1.500 bolívares por litro, en cambio de unos 300 para un tanque completo.
Esta vaina aquí está delicada, mi amor, aquí no está muy...
No, yo sí.
Aquí nadie quiere hablar de corrupción ni de contrabando. Cuando la comunidad quiso hacer contraloría social al tema de la gasolina, hubo amenazas y hasta un muerto. El problema de la gasolina afecta a los productores fronterizos por el tema de las maquinarias y la distribución de productos, pero afecta también a visitantes como nosotros, que para encontrar gasolina tuvimos que desviarnos hasta el estado Táchira, dejando a un lado nuestra idea de llegar a Barinas. Aprovechamos entonces para visitar una comuna local, a la que pertenecen también pequeños privados del sector agrícola, ganadero y de la piscicultura.
No habiendo gasolina se paraliza un poco de cuestión, se paraliza la nación.
El primero en recibirnos es un colombiano radicado en Venezuela desde hace 25 años.
Primero que me dieron una hospitalidad aquí en Venezuela que yo no tengo con qué pagarle, número uno. Segundo, pues el presidente Chávez quiso trabajar mucho por el pueblo, ¿entiende? Ayudando, acordándose a la gente que no tenía casa, pero bueno, desgraciadamente se nos fue.
Pero hay una comuna...
Pues, sí, entonces dejó unos pedestales que hay que... para que no se derrumbe.
¿La comuna es uno de esos pedestales?
La comuna es uno de esos pedestales.
Así concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífico. Agradecemos la colaboración de todos los medios que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Tosti y de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM. Amen. FM Alleluia.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz or freakradio.org, it's Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides. Yes, it's my show. And we're going to be with you for 2 hours here in a pre-recorded show, but hopefully one that's pretty current. So stay tuned. And a particular memorial for dead activist Bernard Klitzner, who died 3 days ago on May 28th. Also some updates from the serious attacks on the survival sleepers at City Hall and an analysis of the phony resource guide being given out by authorities as a sort of protective cover as they drive away homeless people to non-existent shelter. Stay tuned.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of bread lines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. A song that's satirical, putting the mirror into miracle. It must be packed with social fact, or I won't love you. Sing me of kings and conferences martial. Tell me of mills and mines. Sing me of courts that aren't impartial. What's to be done with them? Tell me in rhythm. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must be tense with common sense, or I won't love you.
And welcome to Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides, the June 1st, 2017 edition. That's June 1st. I'll be with you for 2 hours. Call-in number is non-existent, but there is a number you can call to make comments, though few do. 423-4833 is the number to call. It's also the line for HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And it's also a line if you wish to be involved with Free Radio and to get $500 by finding us a 10x10 space where we can set up our studio again, which we've been out of since the end of February. We need that studio, and we need it fast. You get $500 if you find us one for a year, or a prorated amount of money if you find us one for less than a year. give me a call at 423-4833 if you have any ideas about a rental space inside or outside in the city of Santa Cruz. Or if you'd like to join Free Radio as a broadcaster, if you've got equipment to donate, if you're interested in anything about Free Radio, get in touch either through phoning me or through going to the freakradio.org website, which is where we're broadcasting from. So today we're going to do a lot of tributing, memorializing, and remembering activist Bashful Bernard Klitzner, as I used to call him. He died a few days ago. He's been out of the area for a number of years, but he was very active, and we're going to talk about him more later. It's particularly important, I think, to remember those who've worked hard, because there are now those who are working hard still. There's at the sleep out at City Hall, for instance, which is kind of the, well, it's my focus to some extent, mainly because homeless people have chosen to make it a focus, at least some homeless people. They've showed up at City Hall, and they have stayed there, even though the Freedom Sleepers and the Food Not Bombs meal that is served by the Freedom Sleepers is only happening once a week on Thursday, or on Tuesday, rather. And that happened last Tuesday, and it'll be happening again at the 100th Freedom Sleep Out next Tuesday. The report I got several reports on what happened on Tuesday evening and Wednesday morning. There were 25 or 30 people, in spite of massive police pressure under the new green signs that have been put up by city manager and boss Martin Bernal, or Boss Bernal, as I like to call him, who has decided to run off homeless people through essentially creating or decreeing a new law at City Hall. That is to say, rules that he will enforce as laws through his power as the boss, through Mauro Garcia, head of the Parks and Rec, and Kevin Vogel, head of the Santa Cruz Police Department, through essentially making it a crime for people to be at City Hall after 6 o'clock at night and before 7 o'clock in the morning, and also to be at City Hall even during City Hall hours if you have a backpack that you set down, or if you sit on the low-lying flat wall that's always been used for sitting purposes. A whole series of onerous restrictions that are designed to make it uncomfortable, if not illegal, for poor people to be there. In the days before, well, this last weekend, before Freedom Sleep Out 99 on Tuesday night, people were largely driven away from City Hall. They clustered on some of the side streets, but even there, they were mercilessly harassed. Even people who were ill, one woman who had to be taken to the hospital and then had to beg for a taxi to get back, or some kind of transportation since she was taken back. There was a concern about bad drugs, bad heroin, bad meth, which is spreading in the homeless community, as is apparently drug use. Again, as pressure builds on people, yes, they turn to self-medicating alternatives. And it's, I guess it's one way to eliminate or lessen or deal with the problem of homelessness by simply treating it like Fuhrer Chancellor Hitler treated the Jewish question. If you can't deport him, if you can't scare him away, then put him away. And, of course, he did this in a systematic manner, whereas Santa Cruz City Council and police agencies are using a somewhat more random approach. It essentially involves increasing the intensity of warfare against the poor outside. One of the tactics that's being used by the city is the use of a so-called resources guide as they move in and tell homeless people, you can't sleep here on the sidewalk where you've been sleeping for 2 years, though we have no shelters open for you to sleep at, and we close all the parks at night, and it's illegal to you to be in the Greenbelt area, so I guess you better get rich or leave, is what they're saying, as other communities are doing as well, which of course is self-defeating. You squeeze a balloon in one place and it balloons out in another. But in any case, one of the cover devices being used to give a pretty face to this whole approach is the resources list. And I'm looking at a copy of this now. It was given out to homeless people last week by a couple of the, I think Danielle Long, the social service worker downtown, a couple of other stoolies for the city administration who are acting like there's actual alternatives for homeless people when they're not. And a lot of us who saw this kind of thing happen, have seen this kind of thing happen before, realize that's the case. But it's really important to debunk this kind of stuff in detail. And that's what one activist has taken the trouble to do. And that is what I'm going to talk about now. Jennifer Brown has done an analysis of the resource list, a rather critical and caustic analysis, and it's going to be put out as a flyer shortly. First, the resource list itself talks about, I'll run through a few of the things that they suggest that homeless people can do. They have all kinds of resources. You see, why are they out there on the streets? This is the message being put out to the middle-class community, eager to believe that somehow the city is doing something, and it's only those lazy, dirty, crazy, drug-addled homeless people that just don't understand all the wonderful things the city is doing. Well, here are some of the things they're offering. There's Thursday outreach from 9 to 11 a.m. at the downtown library. That means you get a cup of coffee and you can chat with someone 2 hours out of the week. That's nice. There's no shelter there. There's no any regular food. There's no regular social services. Then there's the Chris Youngren Downtown Outreach Homeward Bound. There's a phone number. That's if you want to leave town, if they decide they want to help you get out of town to go somewhere else. Some people, I don't know the extent of this program, but it was the only one funded by the City Council's Homelessness Commission, headed by none other than Mayor Cynthia Chase. We heard about her analysis. Well, you heard it on the line here, or on the air here, if you were listening to a broadcast a couple weeks ago. I think you can go back 2 or 3 weeks to the Thursday show then, and you'll find her giving her smiley and friendly and amiable essentially a series of evasions and, in many cases, misstatements about what was coming up at City Council and what the Homelessness Commission was providing. In any case, this Homeward Bound program provides no shelter. It says get out of town. We'll help you get out of town, some of you. Then there's 211. You can call for resources in Santa Cruz County. Good luck with that. Second Harvest Food Bank hotline to free food locations only works if you're a nonprofit, as I understand it, or associated with a nonprofit. I could be wrong about this. I'm looking at some of the highlights. Well, let me read you just very, very quickly. Here's the, if you'll notice, none of these are shelter resources. There's a Veterans Resource Center. There's a Walnut Avenue Family and Women's Center. There's Monarch Services for Domestic Violence and Sexual Abuse Crisis. Janice of Santa Cruz, Pets of the Homeless. Suicide Prevention Crisis Hotline. Santa Cruz County Mental Health. Santa Cruz County CalFresh Food Stamps. Senior Citizens Legal Services. Salvation Army. St. Francis Soup Kitchen. Calvary Episcopal Church. Homeless Garden Project. Elm Street Mission. Gray Bears. Elm Street Mission is for a meal. If you want to sit through an hour of fundamentalist Christian dogmatism and mythology. And then there's several meals on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Showers at the Homeless Services Center, Soup Kitchen. There's showers during the weekdays from 11 to 12:30, if you're lucky enough to be able to get into them. And then there's the library, which is already being attacked by middle-class NIMBYs as not driving away homeless people quickly enough, and they're talking about putting up a fence around the library. Well, Jennifer's commentary on this is, of all those things I have read, including the porta-potty at the corner of Lincoln and Cedar and the porta-potty in the parking lot near Mission Center and Cedar, not to mention the porta-potty, the glorified Posner porta-potty at Front Street and Laurel, all of these have no disabled access, no washing facilities, and I've heard mixed reports about how filthy and how badly clean they are, and often how they're locked during the day. And indeed, it says 10 to 6 a.m. is when they're open. But of all the bathrooms in the area, in the parks, at the city hall, and in the parking garages, none of them are open at night, after 10 o'clock at night. And the claim is that the sign is up at City Hall. It says they'll be vandalized or there's closed for vandalism. And when you go in to see the bathrooms, say when City Council is open, one of the few times they do open the bathrooms, and they now close these during the day, there's no vandalism there. It is they're using the specter of vandalism to make the area uncomfortable and inconvenient for homeless people so they won't be tempted to come and use the bathrooms. which they desperately need far more than ordinary folks who have houses with their own bathrooms. There's a lot more where that came from. Some of the comments from Jennifer, who did a blow-by-blow phoning to each of these resources, was no shelter whatsoever was found in any of these places when contacted by all the homeless persons who reported back after contacting these resources provided by Danielle Long as she woke people at 5 a.m. who were sleeping at City Hall. And I'm going to continue with this list later in the program to kind of round out the kind of really toxic fantasy being spread, the sort of phony, rosy backdrop to the violent attacks on homeless people. And I don't mean they're beating them up. I mean they are waking them up and driving them to nowhere and taking their property. And that is, yes, a very fundamental form of violence. But more on that later, because I have on the line an activist from the North who has been in the past a longtime worker in Santa Cruz. I call him Dangerous John. It's John Teelking. Hi, John.
Hello, Robert.
And you are calling because activist Bernard Klitzner, who I call Bashful Bernard, died 3 days ago, or actually 2 days. He died on May 28th. And you have...
What?
Yeah, something like that. He, you have some thoughts about that.
Yeah, I knew Bernard. He was doing my taxes when he was in Santa Cruz and also when he was in the Philippines. And they were good friends. Last time I saw him was in Las Vegas. He had a condo in Las Vegas. He was staying there for a while before he moved to the Philippines. And I went to see him for a few days in Las Vegas. So we had a nice time there. And I just wanted to relate a couple of things from Bernard's history as an activist in Santa Cruz. I believe he was a member of the coffee class, wasn't he, at the Mayor Cronin's office or Mayor Fitzmaurice's office?
That's correct, Mayor Fitzmaurice's office. And actually, we have a lengthy interview with fellow activist Becky Johnson, who talks about that, too. Yeah.
Yeah. And then also, I remember a rather humorous episode where Bernard was protesting the sit on that bench for more than an hour, get a ticket law, and he tried to get arrested by sitting on a bench for more than an hour, and no one would arrest him.
Yeah, no, yeah, that too is part of his history, no question. It was part of the whole series of anti-homeless laws that we, as members of HUF, and he, as part of his human rights organization, which he formed independently with activist Bob Patton, and I guess you were a part of that group too, weren't you?
Yeah, I was part of that until I moved to San Jose and 2005.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know before that, Bernard was involved in the movement to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. You want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, we had a coalition called Santa Cruz Coalition to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal, All Political Prisoners, which I was a member of back in 1999 to 2000, somewhere around there. It was 2003, probably.
Explain who Mumia Abu-Jamal is.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is a former member of the Black Panther Party, former radio journalist, current radio journalist, actually, if you count Laurel Handerhand's Prison Radio Project, who records his commentaries over the phone from prison. He got arrested and railroaded into death row, accused of shooting a Philadelphia police officer, Daniel Faulkner, to death in 1981. And there's varying accounts of how that went down, many of which claim that Mumia had little or nothing to do with the death of Officer Faulkner, and including the tape of Arnold Beverly, who claims that he was the guy who actually shot Officer Faulkner. I'm not sure whether that's credible or not, but that's what he claims.
John, what kind of success did you and Bernard and the coalition to free Mumia have in Santa Cruz?
Well, back in, I guess it was 1999 or maybe 1998, somewhere around there, we had pretty big marches in Santa Cruz. We had big marches in San Francisco, too, but in Santa Cruz we amassed maybe 300 people that marched down from UCSC down to the general along parts of, I guess it was 1 to the clock tower.
Any other memories you have of Bernard?
I just remember him as being a real nice, soft-spoken, real nice guy.
He was. He was a sweet guy.
Yeah, he had a kid. At least one kid, I think. He had one kid with one woman who divorced him. And they were trying to figure out how to see the kid and keep the ex-wife happy and everything. I'm not sure how that worked out, but I remember seeing the kid once or twice.
Indeed. Well, any reports from up? You're still up in Eugene, yeah?
Yeah, I'm still up in Eugene, and I'm dismayed by hearing about what's happening with the blocking the sidewalk charges that are being leveled against the activists in front of City Hall. I guess it's my understanding that doesn't California have a state law which makes it a official understanding that people have to intentionally block the sidewalk before they can be charged with blocking the sidewalk?
That has been my understanding in the past. It's my feeling that a lot of these charges are designed to harass, so that the person has to go through the trouble of going to court or posting a bail, if you want to do that way, which is rare with infractions here in Santa Cruz. People just generally go
to
court.
As far as Oregon goes, I'm not sure what the state law is here, but I do know that both Eugene and the city of Springfield have a bee in their bonnet about people setting up tables. Well, in Eugene, they let you get away with setting up stuff on the sidewalk, but in Springfield, they specifically claim that you would be charged with obstructing the sidewalk if you set up a table on the sidewalk that's anywhere, even if it's a really wide sidewalk that has that room.
It's particularly ridiculous in Santa Cruz, particularly on Pacific Avenue, where the sidewalks are hugely wide, but the city has made it a point to create a whole network of essentially activist hostel and homeless hostel and performer hostel laws that establish only very small areas where you're supposedly supposed to be setting up tables inside these brass disked squares or rectangles.
That's kind of ridiculous. Yeah, I agree.
Well, thanks, John. Is there more you want to say on this?
Personally, I'm looking forward to trying to go back to work and try to get rid of my SSDI because I don't believe that Trump is going to preserve Social Security, so I'm looking to track that on my own, but I'm really too slow. That's the reason why I got my SSDI in the first place, so I'm hoping to up my skill set by studying MS Office for Dummies 2016 for the next 2 weeks and see if I can ace the skills test at the temp agency and see if that will accept me.
Well, I wish you luck with that. You're no dummy. Yeah. You're no dummy, John. I know. I've lived with you for
a number of
years. And everyone has their own pace in life, and that's just how it is.
Yeah.
The fact that society insists you march to its own militarized or corporatized drummer is ridiculous, and I'm glad that you're, taking your own road.
Tell her multitask before my wife.
Well, I'm going to leave it there, man, because I've got to roll into this constrained two-hour space, so I will, I guess, be beating my own drum here, and I'll let you go.
Okay, all right, I'll talk to you later.
Hey, thank you.
Carry on. Happy birthday, too.
Hey, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
the scene of the gallant South, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here's a strange and bitter cry.
And that was Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit from the 30s. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. Number to call if you have comments on this show, though it is a pre-recorded show, is 423-4833. To continue with some memories of Bashful Bernard Klitzner, I'm even going to play some of his stuff later in the show, trying to link it up with what's happening currently, as well as to give us a I think a refreshing, well, refreshing might not be the word, but educational reminder of the kind of struggles that went on in the past. Some of them failed, some of them, well, successful in that they recognized the nature of the beast that we are fighting rather than ignoring it or soft candy coating it, whatever.
Okay, well, I'm on the line with activist Becky Johnson, who has finally escaped from Santa Cruz and is in more reasonable housing to the south. But she was a compatriot and fellow worker with dead activist Bernard Klitzner, who died on May 28th of cancer. And
not to mention co-defendant.
That's true. I want you to bring that up too, Becky. You were a co-defendant with Bernard in the famous Coffee clutch
dream, along with yourself.
Right on. Why don't we talk a little about Bernard and your memories of him?
Well, Bernard was an accountant by day and an activist by night, or in whatever other time he had. He was very moved by the sleeping ban in the city of Santa Cruz, and it was just couldn't stomach that, and was very persistently showing up at every Huff event that we had to pressure the city on the sleeping ban. And then At one point, it just looked pretty hopeless. There's just no movement at all. Tim Fitzmaurice had just taken the office as mayor. This was 1999, 2000, right around then, December and January.
2000 of December, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he said, Bernard says, no, we've got to keep the pressure up. We've got to keep. So we put together this event for a very small number of people called the City Hall Tag Team peach gin and coffee clutch, or some funny little name like that. But and we actually had 17 people who showed up at Tim Martha's office, and I'd call it a sit-in because of all the sitting we did. But usually in a sit-in, you know, you go in and you sit and you sing songs and you chant and you have signs and you wave them, and when it comes closing time, you don't leave. That's a sit-in. This wasn't that. This was, we went in a couple hours a day, every day, when the office was open, and sat there asking to speak to the mayor, and to the sole goal was to get the sleeping ban on as an item on the city council agenda.
It should also be said, Becky, that this was over the winter when there was an absence of adequate winter shelter, as of course there is now for sure. And we also, did you mention that we were serving coffee right outside the mayor's office, hence we called it the coffee clutch?
And lovely pastries as well.
Indeed. And we,
which Tim Fitzmaurice never came out and had a pastry or a coffee.
Yeah, and the point was that Fitzmaurice, who was one of the three so-called liberal or progressive council members, the three amigos, as David Silva used to call them, who were elected in 1998 as an alternative to the Rodkin-Matthews conservative regime, and they apparently weren't so progressive when they got into office.
I don't know what the story was. You know, here we supported them getting them in office, and they had made promises, and then if there's a big difference between electing someone and having them go forward and fulfill their campaign promises, that's for sure.
And they had a council majority.
So here's this coffee clutch. We had 17 different people that...
And it should be noted, I'm interrupting this interview, which I did earlier, to note that one of the members of that council majority, Christopher Crone, was recently reelected to city council. And while Crone has made a few, I would call progressive attempts, he's been more accessible to at least chatting. He has a Tuesday meeting before every city council meeting in the Cafe Pergolesi at 9 o'clock, or at least that has been his practice. If you want to check it out next Tuesday, for instance, on June 6th, you can go in and chat with him about the council agenda. I found a similar problem with him as with city council elected member Sandy Brown, who simply does not fulfill commitments that they make verbally. Thus, you know, as... Maybe it's not as important. I think it probably is as important to me that council members be clear about what they're willing to do and what they're not willing to do, and that they not shine you on or schmooze you over. And I'll get this, oh, come on, all politicians do that. Oh, don't be unrealistic, Robert. Well, I think it's extremely realistic to demand honesty from people who are given the extreme power of representing the community and impacting how people live and how people even survive if they're poor. So, for example, when Crone has made a commitment, as he did, or seemed to, after initially wavering on this, and that I found regrettable, if not contemptible, about, you know, making such things as a public request for the police chief, who's now an outgoing police chief, Kevin Vogel, to make clear and open and expose to the community the police reports, the witness reports of the police shooting of Sean Arlt, Officer Bailey's shooting of Arlt back in, I think it was Bailey. Forgive me, Officer Bailey, if I got the name wrong. I don't mean to slander you. I certainly mean to criticize whoever did it and to hold them accountable. Back in the fall of last year, Crone has declined to seek a whole variety of public records. And often you get this excuse, oh, we can't do it without a council majority, I'm powerless, but let's wait till the next election and we'll get two more members and everything will be different. And actually what we're talking about in this discussion with Becky Johnson and Bernard Klitzner remembering him is that we did have four members, three of whom were elected and one of whom was on the council. It was Mayor Catherine Byers. Actually, there was she was part of the council majority. Councilmember Catherine Byers, Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice, Councilmember Chris Crone, and Councilmember Keith Sugar, and they backed away from virtually every particular commitment they had made on the progressive issues around the kinds of civil rights matters I raise in my programs regarding the rights of homeless people, community control of the police, transparency in government. All those things were turned down by this council once they were in power. Things like the re-examining the role of and the competency of the city manager, who was then Dick Wilson. His assistant was the up-and-coming Martine Bernal, and the city attorney, John Barisone, whose second-in-command was Tony Condotti, who's now the city attorney. Taking here is, as we remember Bernard Klitzner and the coffee clatch that went on in front of Tim Fitzmaurice, then Mayor Fitzmaurice's office, where homeless people were given coffee and pastries in order to encourage them if they had concerns about going in, wanting to talk to city officials who had promised to end the sleeping ban, promised to establish emergency shelter, promised to end the citation of people for life-sustaining behavior like sleeping, camping, covering up with bedding. These officials, even so Green Party a politician as Tim Fitzmaurice, who was officially a Green Party member, his refusal to take action on these was ultimately followed by his attacks on activists who called him on it. It was really quite a wasn't really an eye opener. I suspected that was going to be the case all along. But the idea was to open the community's eyes to realize that lying politicians are not a way to go in trying to find solutions for problems in the community. And lying politicians are, it's almost a definition of the word, because politicians will tell you that, oh, they have to get a majority, oh, they have to get reelected, oh, they can only do a certain number of things, oh, they have to please their constituents, and so forth. But the important thing to me, for example, with current council members Crone and Sandy Brown, is that they keep the promises that they have made verbally and publicly to me. If they don't want to keep the promise, then they have to say, you can back down, you can say, I was wrong, I can't do it, I apologize, or this is the new situation. But instead, what these politicians have done is they just remain silent, and they try to ignore you and act like they don't hear you. You're some sort of marginal squeaking off in the distance. Whereas the issues are very real. Why, you know, what is going on with the Department of Homeland Security and ICE, that they have an ICE agent sitting in the police department? Let's see the correspondence between Chief Vogel and the ICE and the DHS. All I asked for Brown and Crone to do was to make a request, a public request, an email form to Martine Bernal that his employee, Chief Vogel, be required to reveal that correspondence, just as he'd be required to reveal the reports of the murder of Sean Arlt by a police officer, killing, I'm sorry, because he was attacking them with a rake, or he was coming out of a backyard in the dark with a rake. Similarly, there are a number of other things that only involve making a simple email request, and these two have yet to do what they promised to do. And so let's get back to Bernard Klitzner, though, who saw a lot of this and stood up for it and fought for it and suffered for it, too. We were all taken to court in the coffee clatch affair and driven away from City Hall and City Council, again, similarly to what's going on now as an attempt to crush a politically embarrassing exposure of what the mayor and the city council was doing and was not doing around issues that they'd publicly committed themselves on.
Participated in some homeless, some housed, but after the 17th day, we got hit with a temporary restraining order aimed at only three of the 17 of us. Yourself, myself, and Bernard Klitzner. And so that's how we became the Coffee Klatch 3.
And we eventually were able to beat it 6 months later with the help of volunteer attorney work, but it kept us away from city council, it made us anxious about being in the city building, and it effectively did end the Coffee Klatch, which I've suggested...
Oh, it did, and...
I've suggested that be resumed, you know, because I think it was, in its own way, an effective tactic. Go ahead, Becky.
Well, just all these other organizations in town wouldn't support us, just on the face of the charges.
But,
and even though 6 months later none of them were proven, and Judge Stevens dismissed the case for the suit as being without merit.
Right. I mean, even though I think that the history of that is very interesting and important, but let me draw you back to Bernard, because that's really what this is about. It's a memorial for him, and it's a memorial for what you remember about him.
Sitting on a bench on Pacific Avenue.
Can you repeat that? I'm sorry.
They passed a law saying that you could only sit for 1 hour at a time on a bench on Pacific Avenue.
That's currently the law.
Bernard was outraged by that. He thought that was ridiculous, that people should be able to sit on a bench, and this was obviously aimed at homeless people. And so he went down and decided to sit for more than an hour in a, kind of, again, another one of these civil disobedient sit-ins, you know. He sat there for hours and hours. He finally had to give up. They would not arrest him.
I remember, because I actually have the sign that he used, only allowed to sit for more than, for an hour on a bench, come and watch me. And I tried to get, I don't know if it was Officer Bechtel, I think it was another officer, a female CSO, community service officer, tried to ticket Bernard because that's what he wanted done, and she refused. It was, of course, an outrageous situation that essentially allowed the police to engage in a lot of bullying of homeless people without having to ticket, which is what we're doing now at City Hall with the survivor sleepers. We're talking with Becky Johnson, who's a colleague of mine and of Becky, of Bernard Klissner's. Bernard also formed...
Another co-defendant.
Indeed, and he... He also formed with Bob Patton the Human Rights Organization. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, they went around to lots of different organizations and also did some fundraising. And they were hoping to file a lawsuit against the city for the sleeping ban. It was just sort of ill-fated. I worked on that effort. I remember I wrote up 17 different declarations from homeless people regarding what their experience was. But this is kind of an odd little thing. I'm not sure of the date right. I think 2006, maybe. They had changed the law, not at the city level, but at the county level. They were no longer arresting people who hadn't met their tickets, and then that ticket was the warrant, and then they would arrest them on misdemeanor failure to appear.
This was actually a court action that wasn't a change in the law, but it was a change in the court practice. So that what the courts actually decided to do was what San Francisco courts have recently decided to do, which is essentially not try to chase down people on infractions with warrants when they don't appear in court because it simply was too costly. Is that what you're referring to, Becky?
Yes. And they changed it so that when a person did not pay their infraction ticket and after a certain length of time had elapsed, they would send it to collections as a debt, a civil debt, not as a criminal action. And this had a very big effect on homeless people with their tickets because they would not get arrested anymore for that. And unfortunately, it messed our case up because our case was based on the fact that a person shouldn't have to go to jail for sleeping at night. And it sort of... they wouldn't. They would maybe have a civil debt. You know, maybe they would have their professional licenses would be not renewed, or they could attach their assets.
What Becky's talking about, and I believe this becomes clear later, is there was an attempt about 11, 12 years ago, maybe a little more, to involve the National Law Center for Homelessness and Poverty and other local attorneys, and some attorneys from out of town, in a challenge to the sleeping van sections of the camping ordinance, based upon cruel and unusual punishment, the fact that this violated a due process for homeless people, the fact that it denied equal treatment of the laws, and one of the key aspects to it, as Becky is pointing out, was that one of the reasons the National Law Center, a Washington, D.C. based group of attorneys and writers who put out regular reports on anti-homeless laws throughout the country, I recommend people check their website. They've got some good writing, though their attorneys are not terribly helpful often in the ultimate analysis, at least haven't been here, in my view. National Law Center backed off when the county changed its policy of not arresting people for warrants issued when people failed to appear in court for a sleeping ticket or a camping ticket. Instead, they would simply, as Becky was saying, send the ticket south for collection with an additional fine added, which is what they do now, which San Francisco is beginning to do. And this meant that because the jailing provision was removed, National Law Center did not want to risk its economic capital, or didn't feel it had a good enough, strong enough case. And so homeless people were hung out to dry here for the last 11 years.
With homeless people, they don't really have assets, so it doesn't affect them in the same way.
I think it also affects the driver's license, although how many homeless people often have vehicles, though some do and sleep in them. But this is, though, an important issue, Becky. It's not really one that, you know, that, again, I'm focusing on Bernard. You know, he was a slow speaker, sometimes clumsy in what he had to say, and he was also, in my mind, somewhat plodding as he went along. But he also was very determined. He wanted to get to the bottom of things. He joined the ACLU in order to, quote, give them a chance to prove themselves. He went to their meetings. I tried to tell him that the ACLU was a useless group locally, that he was not interested in the civil rights of homeless people. You remember that situation?
I do remember him taking it and getting them to put it on their agenda, and I think you and I and Bernard were there again at their meeting, and they basically didn't do anything.
Any other memories? Any other memories of Bernard himself? Because again, I'm trying to get some memories of him. I'm going to be reading Bella, his partner's eulogy, if I haven't already. And do you have any thoughts about Bernard personally?
Well, I think when I first met him was when we were doing this work with it was out in the beach flats and those two apartment buildings that were...
What is now the Nueva Vista Project, then was called the Dolphin Lee Project.
The Dolphin Lee Project, yeah. And he got very involved with that, and I just, you know, was surprised at how much he jumped in, because you see people who maybe were homeless at one point, and then they're formally homeless, and they seem to be really solid activists and supporters for homeless people because they come from their own personal experience. Bernard didn't come from that direction. He was pretty profoundly a middle-class guy, he had a condo and a wife and a little boy, and you know, he just didn't come for that, but he just had this passion for social justice, and it drove him.
He was also an accountant. I mean, he was a studied professional. You there?
I'm here.
Go ahead.
He moved to Las Vegas a few years back, and I saw him on one trip. He came here to visit in Santa Cruz, and I talked to him on the phone a little bit. I was very surprised to hear that he passed, because I didn't know that he was sick at all. But according to Bella's email, he was diagnosed with bladder cancer 8 months ago.
He was also a big advocate. This is how I first ran into him, with fellow activists John Teelking and Jim Costner, of the struggle still continuing for freedom for Mumia Abu-Jamal, or at least for a new trial for him.
Oh, that's right. He really was very strong for Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Yeah.
I also got in fights with him, too, because, there were two occasions. One was when we got the TRO for the Coffee Clutch 3, and he wanted us to put the press release out without his name on it, which was just crazy. And he didn't want his boss to know about it or something. So that was kind of problematic.
I don't remember that he was ever I don't remember that he was ever punished for doing that, although we did get some, probably one of the few times that the three of us got favorable publicity in the Metro Santa Cruz, which is now the Good Times.
He was punished because he owned a house and had property, and so therefore all of those transcripts and things for the Copy Clutch 3, he had to pay top dollar for. I was able to get them because I was low income, and so those were waived for me, and there was no cost for me. But Bernard really ended up paying through the nose, even though he was exonerated at the end.
Yeah, the Coffee Clutch, it should be said, I don't want to go into great detail because, again, we're focusing on Bernard, but just so those, most of our listeners don't have any idea what that was, but it was an attempt by the mayor to use one of his subordinates, a secretary, Anna Brooks, who still works for the city, to drive away the homeless people and those of us who were supporting them from coming to the door every morning and sitting in the offices of the city council. Used to be somewhat more commodious than it is now, and just waiting for the city council members to come in and say, look, we want to talk to you about this sleeping ban and the shelter shortage. We want to put on the agenda, and we want something done as an emergency action during the winter. And the mayor, then Fitzmaurice, who was a Green Party member, wanted nothing to do with this, even though the Green Party itself had adopted a platform that asked for the repeal of sleeping ban laws statewide, I believe. Am I correct in that?
The Green Party has one of the best platforms around for any on homelessness and civil rights. And we were very disappointed in Tim Fitzmaurice's performance on homeless issues.
But I think that you and Bernard, and me, we decided. They tried to drive us away, to threaten us, to get out of here, we're going to start arresting you for being here. They couldn't really find anything to arrest us on, so they eventually settled on a civil lawsuit claiming we were harassing the city clerk,
Anna Brooks,
for, I don't know, asking for change for $20 bills, or asking to see documents, or borrowing a pencil, or eating food, stealing food from the food bin that they had.
Putting our personal belongings on a table, helping ourselves to their office supplies. These were the charges that City Attorney John Barisoni sat down and wrote up and filed against us.
But the main point was to stop this Coffee Clutch, which they did. They were successful, just as now, They're beginning to arrest people or to at least cite them for 647E penal code violations outside City Hall, because every night there were people sleeping at City Hall, not just the Freedom Sleepers every Tuesday night, but every single night there were a dozen or more people sleeping there, sometimes as many as 30 or 40. Although we had a goodly number last night of the Freedom Sleepers. I wasn't there, but I came briefly, saw it, and I did an interview Abby Samuels in the morning, who was arrested, by the way, for refusing to get up from the sidewalk, even though she wasn't blocking it. And, you know, it was after the, I don't know if it was after the 8 o'clock time. But they were able to successfully stop that. Any more thoughts about Bernard? Anything else you remember that he's done that strikes you, Becky?
I'm sorry. I guess I had the other little argument with him about his Free Palestine bumper sticker. Because he was Jewish, but not, he was like an atheist.
I don't know what his religious belief was, but I mean, I know he was leftist in his political views. He felt that the Israeli government was violating, basic human rights, which I know you have disagreed with.
Well, I never got heard him actually say that.
Oh, really?
He just said he was, called a Free Palestine, and I said, well, what does that mean to you? And he just absolutely refused to talk about it. He just got very upset and just refused to mention. Of course, he knew, that I would challenge him on what he meant by that. Does he mean that, they're going to free what used to be Palestine of the Israelis, who are the Jewish people? Are you?
And Becky was extremely militant about her advocacy for what would I regard as a pro-Zionist policy. She denies that's an appropriate label, but she was seemed to be pretty active in stating that anti-Semitism and anti-Israeli government positions were identical, or if you would link these together, or that she would call people who were opposed to the Israeli government who were of Jewish origin or Jewish faith self-hating Jews and so forth. And there was a considerable disagreement between Becky and other activists. Bernard was one of them in the movement. They wouldn't even talk to her about it because the disagreement was so strong. And I always think it's, it can be profitable to discuss issues even where people are far apart. But the problem can also be that there are positions people have taken that they've taken. They're not going to change their position, or at least until new evidence is presented to them, and they may differently interpret the current situation. And folks are entitled to do that, and they will do that, and they do that. And nonetheless, Bernard and Becky continue to work side by side around homeless issues in spite of disagreements on other issues. Unlike, for example, Free Radio, which banned Becky and threw her out because of her association with a right-wing radio station. They made, I thought, was a spurious claim that she had compromised the security of the station by revealing the name of a Free Radio person who everyone knew the name of anyway. I thought it was bullshit, and I still do. But I also have a personal connection to Becky. We were a couple for a number of years, and so I'm not obviously the most objective person, but I try to be fair in my assessments. In any case, this is about Bernard, so let's hear some more.
We're going to, drive them out of there now and set up an Arab state called Palestine? Is that what you mean? I couldn't believe that would be what he would want. But he refused to discuss it with me, so it really kind of remained an unresolved issue between us.
Have you forgiven him? Have you forgiven him, Becky, for this?
I'm thrilled to have known Bernard and been side by side with him in the trenches. He was a great guy, it went way beyond what any ordinary person would do faced with a civil rights issue in his own backyard. And I miss him.
Yeah. Any reports from Seaside while we're talking to you? Because I know you're living out in that general area now, Becky, south of Santa Cruz.
Well, I know that the Selena's shelter just opened yesterday, and that's the one that the Transportation Commission had shut down.
Yeah, it should be said.
A lot of NIMBYism, I thought.
I think it must be said this, and we're skipping now from Bernard, so thank you, Bernard. And, you know, I'm going to be, if I haven't already, I'm going to be playing some snatches of Bernard's past interviews and his confronting city council and that sort of thing. He spoke up at city council. I mean, you know, everyone has their own manner of speaking up, and, you know, he fumbled with his words frequently. But his heart was there, and he was determined, and more determined than 99% of the population, at least on this particular issue. So, but yeah, regarding Salinas,
that's Salinas. Seaside, there's just an article about something to do with homelessness yesterday in the Monterey Herald.
Yeah, but before you turn to that, before we get to that, Becky, you were talking about Salinas, and I just wanted to say that...
Salinas I know a little more about.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I go back to Salinas is because what happened over there recently was a really unique and determined organizer and activist, Wes White, who helped essentially stage manage and support over a six-month period the so-called Flagpole Community, which took the refugees from the destruction of the Chinatown encampments, which is the area right next to the downtown City Hall in Salinas, and set up a nighttime place for them every night with tents, and he would store their tents in his vehicle during the day. That was destroyed in September when new laws were passed by the Salinas City Council. He, given the closing of the shelter and the warming centers in Salinas, unlike Santa Cruz, which has proposed no alternatives other than this paltry, actually, this isn't being supported by the city, the 20-person Association of Faith Communities group we have here in Santa Cruz, which helps 20 people. And the rest of the people, more than they are helped by the AFC, are out in front of City Hall, or were until they were driven away in the last few nights by the police and by the Rangers and by the First
Alliance. I can't believe that Martin Bernal is doing up Santa Cruz.
Yeah, he's the city manager, of course.
I mean, you swear he was a Trumpy the way he's going at it.
But you know what happened? What happened in Salinas was that the city did not set up a homeless shelter. It was Wes White, who went and he used some of the money, but he was able to get.
Mm-hmm.
He set up a building in the middle. He opened up a building in the middle of Chinatown. He's trying to run it, I think, essentially himself. Although I haven't really gotten a full interview on that. I hope to have more of that. Yeah, what is your thought about our old friend, the city manager?
Well, he had KION down there yesterday. This was the opening at 20 Soledad Street, the new shelter.
And so he's doing publicity
as well. You know,
he
gets the press, too.
That's great.
I think it's the same group of people that were being evicted on the 30th, for April 30th, from the train station building that's going to be demolished for a parking lot. That's where the shelter had been. So this is kind of an emergency shelter opening up to take up that slack.
And I hope to talk to him about it in more detail. But and you're not in Santa Cruz anymore, of course, but you occasionally have shown up. I suspect you may be showing up for the 100th anniversary of the Freedom Sleepers next Tuesday. That's going to be happening at City Hall. In a way, we were scared that the 99th, which was Tuesday night, this last Tuesday night, was going to be a slow draw, or because of all the attacks. I mean, they cleared the streets. The police, using a combination of threats and property seizures and ticketing, were able to drive people away from the City Hall area to the adjacent streets and then start ticketing them on the adjacent streets. And then they're still doing that. But there were 20 or 30 people there at the City Hall on Tuesday night for Freedom Sleep Out 99. But number 100 is coming up. I know you've been somewhat critical of this tactic, wondering, you know, where it's going, but it has produced, at least for the moment, it did produce, and we don't know how long they're going to continue, these survival sleepers who keep coming back to City Hall and sleeping there in spite of threats, in spite of tickets, in spite of even arrests. What do you think about that?
In my recent visits to Santa Cruz, the number of homeless people are super visible, more so than I think I've ever seen. But what happened? They closed down all the shelters. These people didn't go away. Now they're out on the streets and where you can see them. And yeah, and they're in pretty desperate way. And what's the response of City Manager Martine Bernal? Oh, let's just crack down and write more tickets and jail more people and take their stuff and maybe they'll go away. I mean, it is the most backwards policy. It was really fascism in action, really, where the state is taking over the security services of the business owners, getting them out of sight. You know, it's shameful, and it certainly doesn't speak. You know, I mean, you can't get more blue state than Santa Cruz County, and yet that's the way they treat their own homeless people. I don't know. It's just seeing that kind of hypocrisy. It's just stomach turning.
And finally, getting back to Bernard, what do you think his thoughts would be about the current policies, if I didn't know?
Well, he'd be down in front with a big sign and chanting and telling them where to go, you know? He wouldn't have put up with it for as long as he was able to raise a breath against them.
And finally, I interrupted you as you were talking about what was happening in your neck of the woods in Seaside. Is there anything more you want to say about that?
I'm not that much to say about it. There are quite a few homeless people in Seaside. And one of the centers is down at the top of the Laguna Grande Park. And that's where a fair number of homeless people are together. But there doesn't seem to be this heavy police presence for them. The churches have all kinds of programs that they're going on and encouraging people to contribute to. So, it's a mixed thing. There certainly are some NIMBY types, too, as well. It doesn't seem to be as fierce as what's going on in Santa Cruz right now.
Now, I've also heard two things. First, that the Monterey beaches, this is some months ago, were actually almost legally, or at least technically friendly to homeless people sleeping out there. That's number one. This is Monterey beaches, which is down the road from Seaside a bit. And then up the road from Seaside in the marina area, there have been a lot of vehicles parked along the side of the road who are RVs, who are sleeping there, people who are using their RVs as housing, as, for example, you see in incredible numbers in Palo Alto. I was up there recently, block after block along El Camino Real of people in RVs. Palo Alto, of course, is a particularly... I don't know if they call it a liberal area, but it's an area where unhoused advocates have established the right to sleep in your vehicle, at least have for the last couple of years.
There are quite a few RVs on Lapis Road, which is in northern Monterey, and Lapis Road is the road that ends at that cement plant at the beach.
Yeah, I don't know it, but I believe you.
Well, anyway, you probably have driven by on Highway 1 and seen the cement plant there between the Highway 1 and the ocean.
Possibly.
So the road that leads into that cement plant is called Lapis road, and that's the road that all these RVs are on. Mm-hmm. And they tried to, like, put signs up, no camping and stuff, but it really didn't affect it.
Well, I know that we...
Hey, I have to cut this short. I appreciate being able to speak about Bernard and pretty a long association that I had with him. I've probably known him 20, 25 years. And I my condolences to Bella and to his son. You know, there was a lot of love between them, and Bella's words were in her email, were really heartfelt.
Well, thanks, so, Becky.
Thank
and
you
I will...
for covering this, Robert.
Yeah. Well, no, thank you for talking about it. And get back to us when you have anything new to report, Becky.
Yeah, I'll get on it, Robert.
Do it. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye.
Say that it's about the savages. You can say you have a better way to live. You can call it manifest destiny. You can talk of all your civilization will give. You can say that we're a thing of history, and progress is the future you will bring. You can send your armies to these mountains. You can say we'll prosper beneath your king. But there will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose. You can say that our ideals can't succeed. You can say that competition is the only way, and a global system based on greed. You can call yourself a Democrat. You can call yourself whatever you will. You can keep on stamping out the fires you start, so you might stay on top of the hill. But there will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose. All of us are terrorists, madmen bent on destroying all that's free. You can say that we are building weapons as your bombers fly from sea to bloody sea. You can say you're with us or against us, and to die quietly is what we now must do. You can maintain your innocence. You can say that you are many as you represent the few. There will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose.
That was David Rovick's Resistance, a 7-year-old song, apparently, but still here. Still tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM and freakradio.org. And as promised, here's the, I wouldn't call it an obituary, but it was an email that was forwarded to me from Bernard Klitzner's wife. Bernard David Klitzner, born April 12, 1942, died May 28, 2017. In behalf of Bernard, this is Bella Klitzner to inform everyone that he passed away yesterday morning around 11:05 a.m. for a bladder cancer stage 4. His journey for 8 months of struggles and fighting for cancer was ended yesterday. I've been with him through all through times, and I myself was happy to serve and take care of him for the past few months. He is the bravest so far I've known in my lifetime, a person with a great personality, and its uniqueness makes me realize how lucky I am to have known and loved him in these years. He might not be the perfect man for me, but he gave so much in my life, which I am grateful for. So thank you so much, Bernard, for everything. You will be in my heart forever, I can promise you that. I will never, ever forget you. You may rest in peace, my husband, till we see each other again in the other form of life. Thank you for the trust and love for all these years. I will definitely miss you every day, especially with our work with Derek. I know you are in good and safe place now in heaven. Continue, my dear Bernard, for the opportunity of what I have now. Without you, I didn't get a chance to see how nice life could be, so I owed it to you, my dear love, Bernard. You may rest in peace now, and I just want you to know I love you so much in so many ways. Through thick and thin, I'm always here for you, and you knew that until the day you left. I did not go away from you. Be happy in where you are now. I will miss you now. My heart is aching without you, Bernard. I miss you every day. Thank you for having Derek to deal and help me. Love always, Bella. I'm not sure who Derek is. I think it may be their son, or... It's been a while since I've been in touch with Bella and Bernard. I'm originally going to play some more clips from the past for Bernard and his activity at City Council, which is not just sort of a sentimental reminder of Bernard, which may not mean much to people who didn't know him, and there are a lot of folks, I imagine, listening who didn't, and some who did. But it would also be useful because it reveals... The then and now aspect of things throws light on the now and actually, I think, gives more meaning to it. But I may do that on Sunday when I return with another show, although I'm going to be playing a lot of flashbacks for the next month because I've got medical problems I'm going to have to deal with, and I'll be out of commission pretty much or weakened during that period of time. So be patient, all you listeners, or... Hey, become broadcasters for free radio by calling 423-4833 or getting in touch with, probably even better, by going to freakradio.org and hooking up as a broadcaster because your voices are needed, as some of our voices tend to get fainter and more feeble or weakened by different things. I am going to turn now to homeless voices because that's what the show is mainly about. Let's go back now to... place I traditionally go to every Monday, the Red Church, and hear what folks had to say there.
So I'm here at the Red Church. Steve's inviting people to wait inside or on the sidewalk.
And the Steve I'm talking to is Steve the Bouncer at the Red Church, who I'm quite critical of at different points. He runs around, bangs chairs. I just done a little less of that recently, which is good. In order to drive people out of the church and get them to leave, takes away their plates as they're eating, or tends to hustle them along, making them feel like they are simply cogs in a larger machine and they'd better behave or they won't get their weekly Monday meal. That's put a little strongly, but I think it's not entirely off base. This last Monday, I found him at the door telling people not to linger near the door, not to stand near the door, not to sit on the steps. Already the Red Church has driven away people from sitting on the lawn outside or taking food out of the church. It's a series of humiliations which is simply become, I guess, habitual with even religious social services, and even a place where, I make my weekly speeches, and I don't like it at all.
So it's from rags to riches here at the Red Church with Uncle Hans. What's the story, Hans?
The story is that after being on that sidewalk in front of City Hall for 21 nights,
I've been lucky enough to this last week to find sanction, a place to stay, and full-time employment with a contractor from Aptos, and he's totally stoked about everything, and I'm so blessed to be one of the ones that made it. I understand it's a kind of a rare thing, but I did it. And I'm really digging it. It wasn't for
financing a security deposit, first and last.
$100 a month, $100 a day is what I'm saving. I make $140 right now.
So in 60 days, you'll have enough for
I'm going to have a studio, my own digs, and then I'm going to get my eyeball fixed, and then I'm going to get myself a nice little pickup truck, and then I'm back on track. I'm back to being the groovy dude that I was. Was 2 months ago. Yay!
The groovy dude is back.
Right.
Any? What kind of work are you doing?
Construction, custom remodeling primarily.
What kind of a wage are you getting?
I'm getting $25 an hour. I just started on Wednesday. The guy, the contractor, just digs the hell out of me, and so when we get into the finish work, it's going to go up, he told me. But I'm just so happy and blessed, and if it wasn't for people like Abby and Keith and you know, Robert North.
I should be given top billing here, as you know.
Right, exactly. I'm going to have to contribute to your cause.
Well, you already are contributing your voice to the ongoing chorus of...
Yes. I just pray for all the other, everybody else, and all the folks that I've met, and I just seriously hope that they can get the help and get some energy up so they can take care of themselves more so than they are. It's a tough road out there, and just gotta have balls.
Are you indoors now? Or?
Yeah, I'm in a tent.
Illegally camping?
I am legal. Totally legal in the backyard of some senior citizens, and they love me to death. And doing some work on their place and fixing up their backyard and garden, which was overrun. And yeah, it's a wonderful thing. It's on the West Cliff there, and it's quiet, it's safe, and
no complaints from the neighbors about the questionable homeless ne'er-do-well who shows up.
I'm in the sack by 8:00, quiet as a mouse, and get up at 5:30 and go to work. So it's perfect.
We've been talking to that former freedom sleeper. Actually, what are you going to do tomorrow? Are you going to go check it out?
I think I will, yeah. I'm still going to be part of it, yeah, because it's part of my life now, and I want to be active with all that kind of stuff.
Freedom Sleep about 99 may see you there.
Yes, you will. And you as well ought to spend the night.
Well,
and
those spend at least 25 minutes.
City council people.
Lawless Bernal, is that what you're calling
him? Bernal and Martinez Bernal. And all those kind, and the chief. Throw some balls and come out there and see how it is, you know, firsthand. We need help. Give us some help and see how it is.
And we have been talking with
Hans Albertson. Free at last.
Thank you, Hans.
All right, good. That was about, and I guess I'm going to learn because it's a new group that was formed on Facebook or something.
Sure, Gary Patton Save Santa Cruz Facebook group. I think there's an attempt to stop this new library removal and then putting the library in the basement.
I'm talking here with, still at the Red Church, with Julie Scholl of RV Full Timers. That's her, I think it's her Facebook page. She's talking about... She's often sending me articles around what's happening with people in RVs, and I've gotten some articles recently. I haven't really had time to fully digest, and we're discussing Gary Patton, who is an old-time environmentalist who at one time was helpful in assisting homeless people in the mid-80s, so many decades ago, as the county tried to pass an anti-homeless camping law. It did, but only for a very small area, thanks to the lobbying and intervention of then-supervisor Gary Patton. Since then, he hasn't done too much around homeless civil rights issues that I've seen in the 3 decades I've been around, but who knows? Maybe I've missed some things.
Out of a parking structure that will be placed over the farmer's market area at the corner of Cathcart and Cedar Street.
That would make it unfriendly to unhoused individuals?
Well, it's already unfriendly to unhoused.
Will they open up the parking garage for unhoused individuals? That would be perfect.
Well, only if you don't bring your backpack
with
you.
And then the old library should be opened as a day center for unhoused individuals, right?
And
what we're talking about is a plan opposed by a number of people, not just homeless folks, to essentially either demolish or use the existing library as a storage area for Martine Bernal's files, or whoever, whatever city agency he delegates or designates, and instead moving the library to the basement of a, I don't know, four- or five-story parking structure to be built at the corner of Cathcart and Cedar Streets, which is where half of the farmer's market is now on Wednesday afternoon.
It's a vicious attempt to destroy our community. I can see you.
I love our community.
We've been talking with...
Julie Shaw. Thank you.
Thank you. Talking with...
Sunny.
Sunny, you were telling me that it's been pretty all quiet on the street front, but there has been music.
There's still been music all around, no matter what. There's still love and music, and that's what brings us all out, you know. It makes me feel good when I play my instrument, and I'm sure everybody has their same technique or tool.
Where do you usually play?
Pacific Ave, or just somewhere where I could actually hear, where other people could hear music. You know, I don't like to be indoors on a stage. I'd rather outdoors is my stage.
Any hassles outdoors from the police or rangers?
So far, no. No. Oh yes. Yeah, there is a hassle. Talk about, you know, let's just say an officer had to do his job, but he offered me a ride when I had my left seat on my skateboard. That was cool, so I like that. When an officer could see something with a person's talent and improvising, and he sees what's good, why not? I'm sure I could give him a ride.
It's been pretty good, but no tickets or anything.
No tickets. I haven't had a ticket for a minute, so I'm very grateful for that one.
And we've been listening to
Sunny Lopez.
Excellent.
Lana Wilson.
And you say that you're going to be there.
Yeah, I'm going to be at the Freedom Sleepers tomorrow night.
Have you been there before?
Yes.
And how many times have you been there?
Several times, 10 times, I guess, but that was when they were still allowing us to use our tents. We stopped going after they started ticketing us for that.
What is bringing you back?
Just because now that they've squashed it and there's, like, no one over there anymore, I mean, it's just ridiculous. We have to, you know, show something. And if a bunch of people go tomorrow, they're not going to arrest us all, you know. We're going to send them a message and hopefully do something.
And there were a bunch of people. And I don't know if Lana was there or not. When I was there earlier in the evening and I didn't stay the night, I almost never do anymore. I come and report and then leave, or leave and then report. There was a smaller number of people who had a long, somewhat contentious meeting. I was a part of that meeting to figure out what to do that night if the police came and what to do in the days ahead, because on the nights that the Freedom Sleepers are not there, the Survival Sleepers, those who show up, are now being mercilessly harassed. And without Freedom Sleepers to provide video and to stand up and kind of model resistance to the police, people are naturally backing off. And it didn't happen on Freedom Sleep Out 99 two nights ago. People stayed. There were 25 or 30 people on the sidewalk, according to a morning report from Abby Samuels. Though the police did give out tickets to some people, using a new and what she regarded as phony excuse of obstructing the sidewalk, because she's pretty careful to encourage people to take up only half the sidewalk, which they generally do, according to her account and according to what I've seen, although I wasn't down there on Wednesday morning, at least not, no, I wasn't down there. And there also was an arrest made. Abby Samuels herself was arrested. I may have mentioned this, perhaps not. She was told she was obstructing the sidewalk. She said, "I'm not. I'm trying to rest here. Leave me alone. I have a right to be here. I'm violating no law." It probably was after 8:30 when the sleeping ban law was no longer in effect. And in fact, police have not been enforcing the sleeping ban against the Freedom Sleepers, perhaps, as I've said on numerous occasions because they're embarrassed about the idea of maybe creating a possible lawsuit against them because they have no place to send people legally. There's no shelters open, as I was talking about earlier. Their so-called resources list has absolutely no shelter resources, according to research by Jennifer Brown, who's been calling up and visiting these places and having other folks call up and report back to her. So, Abby was told she would have to be ticketed for obstructing the sidewalk. She said, "I'm not obstructing the sidewalk. I'm not going to sign any ticket until you take me to a magistrate to see if there's probable cause." So they did. They took her into custody. They probably handcuffed her. I think they did. I think that's what I was told later by her partner, Keith. And she was taken to a court, and the judge ordered her released on her own recognizance and gave her a court date to show up for a possible trial. And so that's a strategy I've often recommended to people if they have the time to do it. For Abby, it's kind of problematic. She has a difficulty. She works during the day, and she has to maintain her job activity at the same time, and it can be very difficult. For others, for homeless folks, it's less difficult in some respects if they don't have or they have other places they need to go to. But the value of being asked and being taken to a magistrate before you sign a citation is that it takes up police time. The police are taking up your time. They're harassing your sleep. They're illegitimately trying to essentially deport people from an area to create an aesthetic by denying people's human rights, the aesthetic of the upper middle class, a certain segment of the upper middle class, the NIMBY segment that wants to eliminate visible poverty, and they don't care whose rights they're violating to do that. So when you take up their time and saying, "Good, take me to a court to see if there's a probable cause for what you're doing," you're essentially creating a cost for the police and the courts to do this. Now, of course, that's a kind of friction. You may suffer some retaliation for it. But people tend to gain courage when they're in groups, and that happens a lot on these Tuesdays, and was happening at other times too. But police have cut into the numbers considerably, if not entirely, at least during some nights for the last week. And the survival sleepers were driven away from under the eaves of the City Hall itself, and now then they were driven away from the bricks of City Hall, then they were driven away from the sidewalks in front of City Hall and the sidewalks of the library. Now they're being harassed even on the side streets. It's an attempt to drive them away and out of sight, but encouragingly, they came back on Tuesday night, and there's going to be, of course, a 100th Freedom Sleep Out next Tuesday. And I don't know what the plans are for I'm not quite sure what happened last night, that is to say, Wednesday night, or will be happening on Thursday night. But I encourage folks to go down, take a look, see what's happening, and also to get in touch with activists who are trying to organize this. And I'll be giving out phone numbers. If you call 423-4833. I hope to have a number there soon that will be direct you to someone who's actually organizing lists of people who can help to plan ways of resisting this, not necessarily by having to come and sleep out overnight, not necessarily by risking arrest, although in some cases that can be the most effective strategy, in some cases it's not. But the survival sleepers and the freedom sleepers definitely need your help. You can give a call to Keith McHenry at 575-770-3377. Again, 575-770-3377. From the Red Church.
Here's something.
I like it. And we've been talking...
Lana Wilson.
Thanks, Lana.
Bye.
Health. My legs hurt my health. We're talking to the man whose legs belong to the man known as...
James.
Thank you, James. Well, you're still singing downtown.
Yep, we're still singing downtown. The music will continue on.
Where can people go to hear the dulcet tones of Cooper and Company?
All up and down Pacific, but mostly in front of the Palomar area.
Any particular time?
After 8 o'clock.
No hassles from the late night armed guys?
No. No,
Most of them get off at 8.
What about those idiots in court who were trying to haul you in?
Yeah, they actually went ahead and sentenced me on something that I wasn't guilty for, and that it was my wrong identity. And they went ahead and sentenced me on a wrong identity. It's pretty interesting that the courts are willing to do that and persecute the people like that. Okay. And I told the judge, I said, you tampered with the jury, this was a mistrial, and he covered up for the cops.
Who was the judge?
And the judge, the last one, I had 5 judges on this one case, and the last one was Judge John Gallagher. And after I testified, he didn't even show up back at court. And they went and tampered with the jury, and they didn't even have to because it was a mistrial. So they kind of all got caught with their...
What was your sentence?
Well, they put me in solitary confinement for 5 days. I think because I was inciting mutiny, because it's so unjust.
From inside solitary confinement, you incited mutiny?
No, from inside booking. Because... Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. They're persecuting the people and they're using the people, extortion.
And served your term.
So then they put me on 3 years of probation, and I had a cop assault me.
I remember about a year and a half ago.
And they have pictures and everything, but they had to tamper with the jury. But the cop also assaulted a girl by the same name as my name 9 days prior. So that's where the mistrial came in, is they all were testifying to him beating another woman in front of the roasting company, and I was assaulted in front of Del Williams. So it almost looks like they're hunting you down. And, you know, I told them, I'm a journalist. I'm a political journalist.
People with that name. That
I
could
think
be it.
So. And maybe,
change your name. That's what I'm...
I think that's what we're going to have to do, you know. They like to create these labels for people that are...
What does this probation amount to? What do you have to do?
Oh, I don't know. I don't really even pay attention. I don't defend myself. God defends me, and I'm here to defend other people.
And you also play music occasionally.
And I play music. And I love you guys, and I love F. Santa Cruz. All the angels are here. We're starting the revolution here in about a week or a day or a weekday.
And we've been talking with...
Hey, this is Cooper D'Angelo. I love
Who
you guys.
Who else would it be? Come on. Cooper.
Yes, it's Fassetti.
And Fassetti, you said that you spent last night at the post office and then previously at the levee. How long have you been in Santa Cruz?
I've been in Santa Cruz off and on since 2003.
And for the last couple of weeks, you've been sleeping out at least?
Yeah.
Where have you generally, if you wish to say, where have you been sleeping?
Me? Up to 48 hours ago, I was over at the City Hall.
And what happened there?
The morning I was there, they haven't read, the last morning I was there, they haven't read a chart stating that as of tomorrow, they will be given citations or possibly arrests.
And did anybody actually get citations the next day, as far as you heard?
Not as far as I know of, but I wasn't there.
I drove by there today. I saw virtually nobody there except along the sides, a few folks along the sides.
Yes.
And even across the street at the library, there weren't many people. I hear that people are coming back tomorrow for Freedom Sleep Out 99. Will you be coming back?
Most likely.
And have you been spending any time at the Freedom Sleep Outs on Tuesday night?
Yes, I have.
What's your opinion of them?
Hard to explain.
You were shaking your head. You're thinking about it, it sounds like.
Yep. One minute it's cool, one minute it's not. You never know what's going to happen.
I hear you.
Yep.
Anything you want to add?
Not really.
And we've been talking with?
Fassetti.
Thanks, Fassetti. Okay, I'm right here on the sidewalk talking with...
Devin Pierce.
And Devin, you have some thoughts.
Yes, about the sleeping arrangements. How is it that every time we sleep in a decent spot that nobody harasses us, that we always get harassed? You know? It's always like... Why can't we just be in peace? I mean, for a limitation.
It's a very good question. Will you be coming to the Freedom Sleep Out 99 tomorrow, do you think?
Yes.
Even though they drove people away last week, actually not on Tuesday, but a few days after, as you probably heard, they drove people away from the sidewalk and threatened them with tickets, though I don't know that they actually gave any. So you're coming back tomorrow night.
Yes. And, you know, love to support the fight.
Have you been around town much?
Yeah, I've been here for like a year.
And what's your thoughts on what you've seen? Any experiences you want to pass on?
Well, if you find a spot that basically, you know, that isn't harassed all the time, just sleep there, people. And just think about what time you have to leave in the morning.
Have you often found such a place?
Yes, I actually have.
And so you haven't gotten a lot of tickets, then?
Not from that spot, no. But from other spots, yes.
And do you find you usually sleep alone or in company or with a larger group of people?
No, just me and my company here.
I talked to that woman earlier.
Yeah. She, we tried to, like, you know, keep a...
low profile?
Right, exactly.
As they say.
We have to keep it hidden from them. So they try to sneak us. They always try to, like, say, the people were trying to bitching. But it's like people who walk by or somebody, you know?
Any threats of violence from anyone that you've experienced in the last couple of weeks?
Well, we have come by people who act crazy and, you know, and but no, not really.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts?
Homeless should be allowed to sleep at least in areas that are designated, you know? I mean, like, parks, not, like, certain parks, you know, and get kicked out because that's not allowed there, you know? It's stupid.
I agree.
You should be allowed to sleep in parks.
Yeah, they close them all at dusk, and it's, they're trying to actually close them earlier, or at least they closed City Hall now, of course, earlier. You saw the new signs, probably.
Yes.
So, but tomorrow, we'll see what happens, what people want to do there. And apparently, you're going to be there.
Yes.
I'll certainly be looking in, and you'll be taking the chances, and I'll be doing the reporting.
Yes, I am.
And indeed, the next day, this was on Monday and Tuesday at the Freedom Sleep Out 99, police did not give tickets for people being on the red bricks after 6 o'clock, between 6 and 10. And as of Wednesday afternoon, the contradictory signs were still up. And by that I mean the city has put up new signs increasing the forbidden hours and decreasing the available hours to be at City Hall, banning being in there on weekends, for instance, banning being there after 6 o'clock at night or before 7 in the morning. But another sign that is still up talks only about it being illegal after 10 o'clock at night. I, of course, think any time is legal time at the center of government if you're outside a building and you're not doing anything violent or destructive. It's the center of government. You have a right to be there to petition for a redress of grievances. First Amendment. I tire of repeating this, but I do it anyway because it's really important to say. And there's actually some talk. Steve Plaich has talked a bit about trying to get together an injunction against the... You know, one time he tried to get the stay-away order law challenged, but it was apparently... Well, you're going to hear from him later, shortly in this, if we have any time left, about what happened with that particular case. But it needs to be challenged again. The stay-away thing is a situation where it's not where the courts tell you to stay away, which is more traditional, however illegitimate in its own way, but at least it has some substance of legal process. Police telling you to stay away is bullshit, but it was created by the Parks and Rec Department, ultimately overseen by Martine Bernal and City Attorney Tony Condotti, giving the police the power to issue stay-away orders when they give out an infraction even before you're even charged with an infraction. And such a stay-away order was given on Wednesday morning, I believe it was, to activist Keith McHenry for being slightly in the bricks, which means the brick area in front of City Hall, which is directly adjacent to the sidewalk. and he was told he had to stay away for a and he ignored the so-called stay away order. And what he did was he then went to a city hall the next morning to appeal the order, because one of the defects of the law that they had tried to straighten out with the second reading, as they call it, was the, if I'm not mistaken, was the fact that there was no appeal process for this, and you have to have a right of appeal. But this whole thing requires more explanation, and you will hear about this when Keith McHenry explains it, either on this show or possibly on our Sunday show.
Not just by myself, though.
No, I don't.
It's a team effort.
I think there are going to be people there. Again, we've been talking with...
Devin Pierce.
Thanks, Devin.
Thank you.
Any thoughts? An anonymous report from an anonymous guy that on an intuitive warning from a friend of his, he set your car... Set your car.
No, I was just reading the bumper sticker.
What do you think? All right. So, yeah, getting back to this. I'm making a report, Steve Plate. Do you have any updates for the masses?
I was doing the Faith Community Shelter last night and this morning, and
that's the Association of Faith Communities.
Yeah, so we walked. I went up to Peace to give some folks a ride down into town because there's no bus travel, no bus routes, and so then I had to walk down from Peace myself. So I walked by the City Hall grounds about 7 o'clock, and not a soul there.
That's true.
Not a single soul.
Steve Plaich is a writer. A legal worker, and also a person who's founded the Homeless Persons Legal Assistance Project, someone who I have damned and praised at different times. Here's more from Steve.
It's true. I think I drove by just an hour and a half ago, and no one was in front of City Hall or in front of the library, but around the sides there were still signs of the creeping homeless or the sleeping homeless.
That's Dreamcatcher's crew over there.
It could be. Also, I keep hearing people inside that they're going to come back tomorrow because there'll be more people there, but we'll see.
Well, I don't know about that.
What's your thoughts on that, Steve?
I don't really see any point in that particular protest persisting. You got to put some energy into trying to influence city council or a lawsuit or something. You know, I was going to talk to Ed Fry, and don't put this before I talk to Ed, but I drafted a suit to challenge this newest restriction on the issues, so on the hours. So if Ed wants to take
and
a look at
Hall.
It, yeah, if Ed wants to take a look at it, we might get into Superior Court here, and he can argue once more for a preliminary injunction that we were unsuccessful to obtain during the Occupy. But if Ed's up to it, we might, you know, at least try to get some visibility that way.
And I'm hoping this isn't violating Steve's confidence. I don't think so. He did send me a copy of his proposed pleadings, which he wants kind of kept out of the public view until he's able to review them more thoroughly with other activists and attorney colleagues. He's talking about challenging the new laws, or should I say rules, that Martine Bernal has set up at City Hall, as well as the new police practices, perhaps, that are misinforming people they can't lie down on the sidewalk in front of City Hall, which they can, as long as they're not blocking the sidewalk. There is a law that criminalizes lying down on any part of the Central Business District sidewalk, which is a whole swath of area that covers all the sidewalks along Pacific Avenue, along all the adjacent streets, along a lot of other streets in the area, but not around the library, the Civic Auditorium, and City Hall. So the police are kind of flummoxed there. They don't have a way of driving people away with threatened citations who are engaging in peaceful political protest and or just survival sleeping.
Hey,
chance of other attorneys stepping up? I know, I mean, Ed's a good guy, but, you know, he's...
Well, you know, Judy Berry has always been willing to do that. We just haven't gotten her anything substantive to put in her hands. She still volunteers at Homeless Services Center. She's still interested in doing, you know, lawsuits.
Would she be the woman to do your injunction?
She really doesn't do civil law. I mean, she doesn't really have a very good understanding of it. Ed is better in terms of the injunction because we've done it before with the Occupy. You know, when they kicked us out of San Lorenzo Park. So Ed understands the mechanics of it and knows what he has to show in court. So if we have a strong enough underlying complaint, and I think we do, because this, you know, I think it's probably an unlawful restriction of public access to a traditional public forum.
Say the least.
Yeah.
Now, MHCAN is also something you've been working on. I hear they got a fairly larger chunk of the pie last time City Hall.
They generated a new matrix for how they dispense their community programs money.
The city council did.
The city council did, and it's on a three-year grant cycle now. But what they did was they increased the mental and behavioral health services component of that from 3% to about 15%. So we had a lot better chance of getting some money out of the 15% than we do the 3%. It's just basic, you know, math. But we were able to get $37,000. That's
compared with
nothing.
Last time you got
nothing. We didn't get anything.
Is that going to mean that there actually be a return to the previous policy of serving 200 rather than 50 people?
Oh, we can't do that because we're restricted by what the city says is our conditions of use for that property, which is something else that we're discussing.
But my understanding was that previously wasn't the case, or at least it wasn't in practice.
It's been before my time. My time there...
How long have you been there now?
I've been chairman of the board. I was just renominated and elected just last week. For 2 years, I think, as chairman of the board, and in my time there, we've only been open at 9 to 2, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and can only serve the first 50 clients through the door in the morning. That's it.
Now, I heard from Sylvia that Dr. Daffy Jaffe came to town, who's a big advocate of forced treatment, outpatient assisted therapy.
He was up at St. John's Episcopal, and they were sponsored by NAMI. NAMI and MHCAN have philosophical differences in how they treat people with mental and behavioral health problems. So I didn't...
Did any clients actually also use MHCAN and vice versa?
I couldn't say. To tell you the truth, I don't know. But they have a different philosophy about that. I guess Mr. Jaffe, although I don't really know him well, is an advocate for this Laura's Law forced treatment thing. So that's one of the things that we are on record as being against Laura's Law and any application of that in Santa Cruz County.
You know, it hit San Francisco. How likely is it to hit Santa Cruz?
Not at all, I don't think. I don't think there's any traction for it. The Board of Supervisors doesn't seem inclined to move on that, and I don't think there's any popular will for it, frankly. So I don't think that we're going to have Laura's Law either passed by the Board of Supervisors or applied here in Santa Cruz at any time in the future that I know. But as I say, we're on record as being against it in any form. So, no, I didn't go to the thing at St. Jaffe was at St. John's Episcopal
Something
Church.
Like that, yeah.
And it was sponsored by NAMI, so, you know, difference of opinion.
Now, you also have written about the need for emergency shelter and the sad situation that emergency shelter has been abandoned in favor of the so-called pathway to housing. When I spoke with Mayor Chase in early May, she assured me that there was big things happening or something happening with emergency shelter. But then when I spoke with Chris Crown last week, he advised me that even though they passed $100,000, that has no deadline, no specifics. Nothing before September at the earliest.
That, if you read the budget closely, that $100,000 is simply to implement the options that they had that exist in the Homeless Coordinating Committee's final report. There was another budget item for what they call a winter shelter or interim shelter, but it said that budget had not been established. So there's nobody's put a dollar amount on it. But it is interesting that when in the budget they referred to those projects as if there were two different things, the winter shelter and the interim shelter. So it's possible that they may be planning some kind of an interim sheltering program that would, you know, come into existence before November when the AFC once again commences the winter shelter. We're hoping to do it earlier this year than we did last. Last year we started December 1st because it was an exigent situation. The Homeless Services Center decided they couldn't assume the administrative burden of that, so we had to put together a program in like 2 months and get the money for it and get it organized and get it going, so we didn't start until December 1st. Traditionally, as you know, that program runs November 15 to April 15.
Now
so it's roughly 155 days.
You had hoped to at the May 9th protest to get a large showing, and there was a fairly large showing of folks that came, but you're particularly concerned about outreach to people within in the Association of Faith Communities volunteer group, because they had spent a lot of time in the, you know, at the winter, actually in association with homeless people, and the issue of the sleeping ban, rent control, you know, an emergency shelter, all would be things that they were sympathetic to. How well do you think that played out? And has anybody, you think, I know a few people have joined up, but dealing with a protest that you suggest is outdated. Others have suggested this too. I am ambivalent on the position about the freedom sleepers and the survival sleepers.
Well, I'm not saying the survival sleepers shouldn't continue to do what they're doing. I'm just saying that the freedom sleepers, for what it was, and an effort, you know, with direct action to work some repeal of the camping sleeping ban in Santa Cruz, just simply hasn't worked. And it's not like it's going to. So that energy should really be put into something more substantive. And really the only thing we can do is, if you're political, you can get involved with the Bernie folks, and the next election cycle maybe elect two more progressive members of city council, where you'll have a majority of four, and then that would be a very good possibility to have the sleeping ban and camping ban at least revised, if not repealed entirely. Or the other way is to go into court, and you can, you know, the most effective way would be to file a suit, a Bell v. Boise style suit, and have it heard in federal court, because, you know, we are having the existing problem that was highlighted in Bell, is we have insufficient shelter for the number of unsheltered people we have in our city.
Has there been any move in the Bell v. Boise case?
I mean, I think that federal judges think that that's sound policy. You know, I think they believe that if they had an opportunity to apply it, it would be good law.
If the
appropriate suit came before the district court here in San Jose, and ultimately it would go to your favorite court, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals down south, because I'm certain it would almost certainly be appealed. But we'd have a better than, you know, average chance, I think, of having that be successful. But that's kind of where the, in my view, the energy should be. You know, the
there is a suit against Caltrans, as you know, up in Alameda, that Osha Newman and other attorneys are taking to fight the seizure of homeless property up there. The
problem with that is that that's all restricted to the facts of the case, and it's restricted jurisdictionally. So if it's a district court, it has no persuasive power in any other district court. If it were a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, for instance, decision, then it would have some persuasive power in a lower court, which would be the district court. So, but until it gets, you know, higher up the food chain and in federal jurisprudence, it's just not going to have any practical effect for us. It'd be great for the people in Alameda, but it won't be any do us any good here.
Now, someone said that the presence of the freedom sleepers, however far they are from their original purpose and productive result, does encourage the survival sleepers. That's what I've heard. What's your sense about that?
Well, if that's the case, then, you know, it is serving a useful purpose. You know, if survival sleepers, who I think have, you know, taken it upon themselves, really without, you know, any encouragement from anybody else, certainly not nobody in the community, if they think that the freedom sleepers being there have inspired them to do a nightly sleep out there, then that's great. They should continue to do that, but that's something that they have to do, and ultimately that will be their protest, you know, their direct action, and really not ours.
And you've been checking in on the survival sleepers. Most recently found nobody there.
Yep.
Will you be continuing to keep a weather eye?
Yeah, I always go. I'm always by there. Yeah, I'm up early. I'm in town. If I go by at 6:30, 7 o'clock, I'll check it out. When I go by, you know, later in the evening, I'll check it out if I have an opportunity. They have pretty effectively cleared everybody out. You know, the city council charged the city manager with the duty of retaking City Hall.
They never put that in any kind of language.
Of course not. But, you know, that's kind of one of those sub-rosa things that say, you know, we want you to take back City Hall. You know, the people who are sleeping there are scaring our employees, and they're scaring people who don't feel like they can, you know, freely use City Hall grounds. They're scaring the public, so you take it back for us. That's what he did. I think that probably he's overreached in his authority. I think he's legislated, and even in Santa Cruz, we have separation of powers. You know, you can't legislate and be an executive at the same time. And he's an executive branch of our government. He's not a legislator. That's the city council.
He violated the Brown Act as well.
Well, yeah, and certainly that may be true.
But he's talked to individual members of council.
He has effectively legislated by changing a law that's on our books to suit what he believed would be his own purposes, and clearly I think that's beyond his authority. and somebody should probably call into task in one of those.
Steve Page, could you be the man?
Well, I mean, it's ripe for a lawsuit, I'll tell you that. It would be, I just drafted the papers that had that as a subject. I think that there's enough good law in there, and enough, you have to show a likelihood of success on the merits to get a preliminary injunction. And
we're going to hear more on this, perhaps, on Sunday. Or you can contact Steve Plage directly at 466-6078, 466-6078 to learn more about his thoughts on this issue and maybe get help or advice around M.H. Can, of which he's either the director or the vice chair or, I don't know, chair to the chair or under the chairs, whatever, on the board of directors. Similarly, with a number of other groups, Steve is big on these board of directors and...